So we will move on to the next session. So really providing some, looking at providing some strategic advice to the foundation around the various MOUs or protocols or agreements or whatever we want to call them with various bodies, and hand over to Hugh to talk to us about those.
Thank you, Joanna. So as Joanna said, this session is about the strategy that the IFRS Foundation should follow in respect of our so-called Memoranda of Understanding. We also have things called protocols, which I'll mention as well. And over the years, we've signed a few of these agreements. They're essentially about mutual support, technical cooperation, and in some cases, educational exchanges. They express, if you like, a convergence of will between the parties and to some extent some common intentions. We use them when we're not intending to create a legal commitment as such, or where it's not possible to create a legally enforceable agreement. And it's more in the nature of formalising what we would say in this country is really a gentleman's agreement. So as I say, they're about exchanges of information and mutual cooperation. We have also signed these so-called statements of protocol for cooperation. If you had to try to distinguish them, a little bit more of a practical aspect to them, but in many respects, they're very similar to MOUs. On the second page of the paper that we sent you in advance, you can see the various agreements we've signed over the years, and we've grouped them according to whether they're jurisdictional, international agreements, or we have in one case a constitutional agreement with the monitoring board. All of these agreements, by the way, are on our website if you're interested to see them, and you'll see they're in many cases quite informal, actually, reflecting the fact that they're not legal contracts as such. One of the things that happened, towards the end of 2013, was the fact that the trustees felt or saw that more and more parties were coming to us asking to sign these MOUs, reflecting to some extent the fact that IFRS are now being applied in over 100 countries, and cognizant of the fact that we had this pressure, if you like, the trustees felt it would be useful to think about some of the criteria and the conditions we should think about when signing these agreements. So essentially what the trustees did was come up with a checklist of criteria that we should think about when signing these MOUs. And they're really divided into two different headings. One is matters relating to the organisation and its senior staff, and the other relating to the strategic needs, if you like, of our engagement. So in the former category, we think about the financial stability of the proposed organisation, its reputation, its credibility, and whether it's a well-established independent body, and also what are the management and senior staff of that organisation as well. And we also look at their publications and get a feel for their quality. Then in terms of our strategic needs, it's obviously of interest that we do in fact have a common interest, and we're working one at the moment, and it's been an interesting discussion, what are our common interests. We also look at the international credibility or how our international credibility may be impacted by signing an agreement with whichever organisation we're talking. We think about whether there's a need for formal engagement. Sometimes it might be taking things too far, but so there is a question whether we need to have an MOU at all. We think about the effect that it might have on our resources, which are clearly limited. And we also think about the effect that any engagement might have on the Foundation's other agreements that we have in place. We think about whether the proposed organisation is operating in the field with which we actually wish to cooperate, and whether by doing so we would create some sense of inappropriate endorsement or exclusivity. And also we wonder whether the proposed engagement could potentially have a negative impact on the governance of the foundation or on trustee relations for that matter. And overall, we hope that there'll be a potential for beneficial synergies and efficiencies. So that's kind of a whistle-stop tour of the MOUs we have and the background to them, but more importantly, the criteria and the conditions that the trustees felt were important when thinking about signing these agreements. So we had just really two questions. The first one being, how might MOUs be used to further enhance the strategic objectives of the foundation? And secondly, does the council have any views or suggestions relating to the criteria set out in the paper?
Thanks, Hugh. And I think it is an important area, as we did talk about earlier. There are, and is set out in here, an awful lot of organisations that we have relationships with, or the foundation has relationships with, and looking to enhance, if you like, the mission statement that Hans set out, you know, in front in terms of the relationships with those. And I think the criteria that the trustees came out with, and I think, Hugh, you would say that they are working. I mean, have you put in any in place since these criteria have been out, and they work, these criteria? Like, have you reviewed the criteria?
I personally have not formally thought about the criteria. I mean, we have signed some agreements since I've been at the organisation. David, you want to add anything? But
yeah, since the criteria were agreed, this came up in the context of the renewal of the MOU with the IIRC, where the trustees, I think, were quite struck by the advice from this council again, which is why it was renewed. And we've also taken that into account in the work we've been doing to renew the MOU with IFAC. So it is being taken into account as we go forward and thinking about, because all these MOUs have limited lives and review clauses built into them.
So, and on that basis, I mean, that they are being used on that basis, so I think it is important in terms of thinking about it from this council's perspective of if we think that any of those criteria, there should be things added to, or they're not quite right, in terms of the relationships. And obviously then the first question, you know, can we do any other MOUs, or how can the MOUs be used to enhance the strategic objectives? And I see there are a few people with comments, and I think, Danita, you were up there first.
Just a quick question. The criteria, very first one, on the financial stability of the proposed cooperating organization should ensure that it is and is perceived as being independent. So pick on IFAC for a minute. I think, you know, most of us that have been involved in IFAC discussions would have or know that there have been lots of criticisms of IFAC and its various boards for perhaps not being independent. So how does the foundation think about that criteria in evaluating an organization for, you know, whether it is suitable for having an MOU? And I guess, you know, my personal feeling is I'm not sure that the benefit of these formal, whether you call it an MOU or an agreement or whatever, is necessarily always clear. I think, yeah, there certainly the foundation and the board needs to have, needs to work with all these various organizations, but when is it really necessary to have that formalized in one of these agreements is not entirely clear to me.
Hugh, do you want to comment?
And by the way, I meant to say at the start, I'm sure Yael was supposed to be here and unfortunately isn't. I'm sure she would have many more views than I can give you. The only thing I would say is I think that we, at this point, want to be judicious about how many MOUs we sign up to. It's not the case that every time somebody says, oh, let's have an MOU, we go off and do one. I think we are being more judicious about it, and we think quite hard about what the content of them as well, but I think it's a fair comment that you make.
And I think if you look at the criteria are there as to what they need to have in order to sign one up, but what is missing from that, as Danita, is actually what is the objective of, you know, and what outcomes are we expecting from signing up any MOUs. Now, whether that's actually thought about, if you like, and I certainly think the IFAC question as to, you know, David, you say it's being renewed, as to in terms of the financial stability aspect and independence.
Again, if I focus on the independent view, IFAC, you know, says it does have in its standard setting boards a public interest mission. So if you look, for example, at IPSASB, and we went through the discussions on the IPSASB governance last year, and I know from personal experience of 10 years ago working on an earlier IPSASB governance review, that it does have a view as part of IFAC of working in the public interest. The IAASB, which also has an important link to the work of the IASB, again, is being seen as working in the public interest. So this is something we factor in that's hidden in this, you know, one word of independence.
Lothar.
Yeah, thanks, Joanna. You took one of my comments away already, which is obviously I have the same impression. It nowhere says very clearly when and why do we need an MOU. I mean, that should be the first thing, and it should be spelled out, I think. Then the second thing is also independence, like was raised before. I mean, ad hoc, I do not understand why these organizations' MOUs are done with should be independent. I mean, you want to cooperate with interest groups to get their input. I think it would be more important to have a clear rule of what cannot be part of a cooperation to deal with non-independent interest groups. I think that would maybe be a better way than just say we only talk to independent groups. And as a last comment, you may also want to specify always what kind of consultation is required if I do an MOU from my side in my process. Because, you know, if it's really a MOU to work together, then ISB probably also wants to specify what it wants to do. Those are my comments.
The point of, I understand the objective point is spelled out in the agreement itself, I think, rather than being an overarching requirement. I mean, the first thing the agreement does normally set out is why you're doing it and what you hope to achieve. Now, you know, you may agree or disagree with some of those, but it is thought about. Independent, I hadn't really read that first dot point all that closely before, but I wonder whether it means financially independent. So it talks, first of all, about financial stability and is perceived as being, I think, so that we're not signing an agreement with somebody who's going to go bankrupt next year, you know, that's sort of more the idea.
I guess, and it would almost be like, and I dare I say it, some of our standard is not clear and it needs some interpretation, so maybe somebody should do that.
We put out an exposure to
Nah. But I think the objective bit, I mean, it's not clear in this, but, you know, and perhaps again, it is actually thinking around the strategic the strategic objective of doing MOUs at all, as to, well, what are the objectives overall, and then what are the objectives of the individual ones. And it's now got to arguably, you know, we've got the mission statement. Does it fit with the mission statement? And to link all of our agreements or documents to those same things. And I'm sure that it probably do, but pretty important that it does. Alberto.
Thank you. I have a few comments. One is, it seems that this agreement tends to last forever. I mean, let's take the agreement with the FASB, which goes back to the Norwalk agreement, 2002, I mean, 13 years ago. A lot of water has gone under the bridges in 13 years. I mean, I wonder whether this is still valid, is still or need to be reviewed in light also of the non-convergence, which has not the convergence which has not been achieved. The other one is about the fact that there are jurisdictional agreements between a country which is also part of the international agreement, Brazil, for instance, and I wonder whether there is a conflict between the two agreements. I don't know. I have to go to read through the agreement, which I haven't. Of course, I don't have the Brazilian one. Last one is that the jurisdictional agreements are all between countries or jurisdiction which have not converged yet and might not converge, perhaps, certainly not in the near future. And I wonder whether when the ESB is not giving some privilege to the non-converging countries vis-a-vis the countries which have already converged.
Do you want to comment on those?
The only general thing I would say is that most of these agreements, and I haven't read all of them, but they do contain clauses which refer to the need to revisit them and reconsider their validity. I don't know if we look at the Norwalk agreement, for example, the Norwalk agreement. I don't know when, you know, if that has been revisited since 2002 or not. It probably would be worthwhile to do so.
Does anyone know whether the Norwalk agreement actually has a review date or an expiry date?
No, but I do know it's honoured more in the breach than in the. Alberto makes a very good point. And perhaps we need to do some cleaning up, except that it's a bit painful exercise.
You should mention, too, that Brazil has converged. So.
I suppose that post-implementation of IFRS in Brazil, that agreement might be also more of a dead letter. So I think we need to take a look at...
So certainly one of the outcomes of this discussion is actually to have a look at the ones that we do have and have a clean up. And I think also, and I'm not sure whether it's actually in this paper or not, Alberto, you say it's only with jurisdictions that haven't converged. However, there are memorandum of understanding or something between the ISB and the standard set, the national standard setters that have converged as an ongoing. Am I not right
I was a member of the IFRS? What is it called, the IN that was adopted by IFS?
Yes.
So we have a sort of a code of conduct between us and the national standard setters, which is basically a sort of an MOU, but then it doesn't carry signatures, but this is how we both agree that we should deal with each other. So it's there.
And so, in fact, when considering these as a whole, as you say, it's not called an MOU, but actually it is a very similar kind of thing. And in fact, it predates, or the original one predates IFAS, because I certainly was involved in
it. It has just been completely reviewed.
Hasn't it? Yeah.
What is it called, Henry? Charter, yet another beast.
So again, it's perhaps saying, do we need all these various types? Can we tidy them up? Okay. Vincent. No? Why did I think Vincent had his up? I didn't. Surya.
Thank you, Joanna. I guess most of these are obviously non-binding, so it has to go with a mutual level of commitment in terms of what the give and take is. And to Danita's point, I think the objective at a high level is always there in the MOU, which is mutual inclusion in subjects of common interest. But at a practical level, what is the give and take in the inventory of MOUs we have is perhaps something that I'm not sure there is clarity. Of course, on the positive side, if you're working and partnering with the right organization, there is resource availability, and that's something we need clearly in order to meet our ever-growing agenda.
Yeah, good point. And I also think, as you say, you know, quite how they work, and as Hans says, they're honoured in their breach, or whatever the right expression is. And if we're going to maintain our credibility, then... You know, it's ensuring, well, actually, if we have these, we actually do work within them. Jake.
Thank you. I think this is a very similar point to the one just made. The question I had is how is the success or usefulness of these MOUs actually determined or measured, and how often is that done?
I think most of the recent MOUs that we make have a time horizon of 2 or 3 years or so, and then at that, then we'll have an evaluation and see whether they should be continued or not. So that should prevent in the future these MOUs becoming prevent them from becoming outdated or stale. And
Egbert?
Thank you. Perhaps just two detailed comments, but perhaps also a reflection based on that. The categorization in jurisdictional, international, and constitutional is made, and when I read through these, I could see some of those international agreements actually being jurisdictional. For example, ASEF, you could see that as being jurisdictional, and ESMA, you could also see as jurisdictional. So I'm not really clear as to how you would divide them. And then the thought from that emerged that does it matter in terms of the criteria that you lay into those MOUs? Would you look upon jurisdictional MOUs in any different way than international agreements? Is there a difference in emphasis as you, in terms of appetite of wanting to have that? And let me give you one example. The last criterion in the list is about beneficial synergies and efficiencies. Would that be something that you would consider moving higher up the list for certain MUs than for others? That's the action.
I mean, I think it's a fair point. I think we really included these categories just to help you get a feel for what is out there rather than because we've formalized those categories in thinking about the criteria. But I think you raise a fair point.
Julie?
I was just going to add some context because wearing my IOSCO hat, I was involved in developing the protocol agreement with IOSCO. And so some of the questions were, why did these things come about? I can just maybe explain that one, not that that's the model. But in that case, there was a working relationship for many years. It was just informal. In essence, the interactions between IOSCO's Committee on Accounting and the ISB board and staff, you know, was driven by the level of energy and of the people on either side. So it was a personal thing. You know, if you switch the people out, perhaps it would switch. And over time, it was found to be very useful for both sides. So we just thought something that's very useful shouldn't be driven off just individuals. It should be more institutionalized so that it transcends who's actually in charge and continues on. And so that was the impetus for writing it down, if you will, was that it was fruitful and let's make sure it continues regardless of who's in a position with a 2-year review period, because that's not to say that the future would always be the same. So that was sort of the impetus. So what that would say is, if you use that model, that would say you don't enter into one of these as the first step of a relationship with an organization. You can certainly go back and forth informally and kind of see that it's working and fruitful to the point where you want to institutionalize it. And then, at least in IOSCO's case, that's where it came about. The other benefit is it sort of forces you to not get stale in the relationship, you know, in what you do and what you cover and how you interact. Because the act of writing it down and having to review it every 2 years sort of forces you to pause and think about, you know, is there things we could do better, stronger, faster? And so even for a well-functioning relationship, it sort of has that discipline. So at least in IOSCO's case, that was sort of the impetus and the reason for it. Again, that may not be the only set of circumstances in which you'd want to have one, but in case that helps give some context.
And on top of that, it also has an important symbolic value. The fact that we have an agreement with IOSCO means that we attach a lot of importance to working with securities regulators, and it's important to be able to tell the outside world that this is the case.
Giaf.
Thanks a lot. I came from an organization where we do quite a lot of MOUs. What didn't come clear to me from the presentation, whether or not there is a framework behind this, a comprehensive and consistent framework that guides and govern the MOU process. You have the criteria here. Criteria is but one element of that. It's one element of that. Objectives is another element of that. The scope, defining the scope of this agreement is another element of that. So it is far broader than what you have here. And that is very useful because it gives a process through which you can decide whether to engage in MOU or not. Maybe that framework is there, but it didn't come out from these slides. Thanks.
I certainly think that is a very valid point. And as you say, it doesn't come out from the paper. And Hans saying, like the OSCO one, you know, is there because it in, you know, shows the world we've got a relationship. But those kind of strategic things should be part of the framework to say that's where we would have one. These are the key things we want out of them as part of the framework. And in some ways, it's sort of here, but not very clearly articulated, Hugh. It's probably...
Yeah, I think so. Fair comment. I think it's a fair comment.
So, and I should know the answer to this, seeing as I'm the chair of this group, the purpose of bringing this onto the agenda was to seek, if you like, so with a view to considering what the strategy, because it starts off saying this is our strategy, but effectively I think the input from this group is saying, actually, let's have a review of that and where do we go from here?
No, I think that's right. I think what we have is you know, it's strategy is a grand word to use for what we have, if I can put it like that.
Yeah, I think that's a good finish to that session, actually saying that. So are there any more comments? Because I certainly think that has been, and I think, Gyath, as you've finished it, actually creating that framework and actually creating the strategy as opposed to we've entered into them, you know, as we've seen fit, is probably the way to go and review a number of the ones that are already there to make sure that they're not honoured in their breach, as it were. Useful? Any further comment from you, Hugh?
I think that's been very useful. Thank you very much.